Welcome to the APCDA podcast. Today we're going to meet Azran Osmanrani. Azran is the CEO of Naluri, a digital health startup that addresses mental health and chronic diseases together in a preventative, holistic, and outcomes-based approach. He was CEO of AirAsia X, where he grew it from a business plan to a $1 billion IPO with 2,500 employees in 6 years. And CEO of iFlix Malaysia, which scaled to 20 million users in 20 markets in 3 years. He held previous leadership roles at Astro, Bursa Malaysia, and McKinsey. He holds a master's and bachelor's degree in engineering from Stanford University. He chronicles his leadership challenges in his book, 30 Days and 30 Years. He's also an Ironman triathlete. Wow, Azran, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Felicity and Rachura.
It's really great to have you. We're doing this podcast with people who have really interesting careers, and wow, you know, you have an amazing career.
How I lost all my hair.
And how you lost all your hair. Such a great story. So we'd love to hear about it today for our listeners. So tell us a bit about who you are as a person.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I describe myself on my Instagram profile as an outdoor freak who freaks out randomly. And I love taking things apart, right? Whether it's triathlon, travel, and technology.
What's your favorite out of those?
Oh, it's like trying to choose which of your children are your favorite ones. You can't.
You love all of those things.
Love them all.
So tell us a bit more, though, who you are. Like, what makes you tick?
Well, maybe I think, you know, I like to live by three principles. Curiosity, connection, and courage. And I think that's probably been or shaped from, you know, my early years. Very curious kid, wanting to jump and try different things. Even in university, I just loved learning. I wasn't interested in any particular field, but just the exploration of different ideas, meeting new people, and building new connections.
Yeah, connections. And I'm sure that's helped you a lot with your career.
Indeed.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about more about your younger years, you know, a bit more about what you were like as a kid.
You know, there was, if you've read Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers, where he talks about 10,000 hours. And he has an interesting story about the Canadian ice hockey team, which interestingly has a disproportionately larger number of players who were born in the early January to March months of the year. And that's because they follow the calendar year. And if you start at the very small Pee Wee leagues at 3 or 4 years old, if you were born in January, February, March, you tend to be a bit bigger and stronger than the kids born in October to December. And because you're a bit stronger, you get selected, you advance more in the sport all the way up to professional levels. Well, I'm a December kid. I'm a small little kid. I grew up and, you know, in my little community, the main sport among boys was soccer or football. And I was never good enough to play with my peers. And so being sidelined, I kind of decided I needed to invent my own games and convince the younger kids to join me in these kind of crazy Azran games. So perhaps maybe, you know, always been a little bit of that black sheep, that outlier myself, and, you know, having to create my own, you know, space rather than kind of conforming and joining to established groups.
So you weren't born in the early parts of the year?
No, I'm a December baby.
Ah, see, and I'm an early January baby, so I totally know what you're talking about.
Exactly.
And you proved Gladwell wrong, and it goes totally against his theory of you know, the early borns being so successful.
Well, if you were a professional field hockey player, but, you know, probably not so much in other fields.
Yeah, but I know what you're saying. I'm born in early January, and there were some kids I was competing against that were born on the 31st of December. I had a whole year on them.
Exactly. Yeah. And that spirit of, you know, kind of curiosity and adventure. I think the big turning point for me was, you know, what do I go after graduating from high school, right? And number one, I knew I wanted to go as far away as I can, and not with the where traditionally Malaysians would go to study overseas, right? They tend to go to the UK or Australia. So I said, well, if that's where everyone's going, I want to go somewhere different. I'd love to try the US. And more people were studying in the East Coast. So I said, well, then I want to go to the West. I want to go to a place where there are as few Malaysians as possible. And of course, back in the 1980s, you know, you had to apply for a scholarship and you were only given four choices: medicine, accounting, law, or engineering. I wasn't interested in any of them, but I knew I needed that ticket to get out of Malaysia. So it became a process of, you know, eliminating and choosing the least of kind of the four evils. So medicine, I ruled out because I'm kind of afraid of blood, and the idea that you have to study for decades, you know, was not very appealing. I ruled out law and accounting because their textbooks didn't have pictures and colors. And so engineering it was. But once I got to the university, the cool thing about the American system is you had more flexibility in the choices of subjects that you took. So I took the least number of engineering classes that would allow me to get engineering on my piece of paper. I wanted that option to explore other fields, from economics to psychology. I loved history, ballroom dancing, sailing, just breath, you know, and that's what I, you know, enjoyed and remember most about, you know, those years in university.
Yeah, amazing. And it's good, you know, that liberal arts sort of background that you come from. You can do your sciences, your maths, your engineering, but other things as well.
And even in electrical engineering, which was my chosen field, there are different sub areas, right? A lot of people wanted to focus on computer engineering, electronics. I chose something called control systems because I could get to work with engineering students in other fields like aeronautics and mechanical engineering to build stuff. I tend to gravitate towards, you know, fields where I could meet people from different backgrounds, you know, kind of connect dots in different ways rather than kind of going deep in one particular area.
Yeah. No, it's interesting because you said you've got like maybe a choice of four different things and you chose the one that was, you know, the least, the one that you disliked the least, but you managed to get through right to a master's level.
Yes.
So it mustn't have been too bad.
Well, because you know why? The one thing that I really was obsessed about in university was Ultimate Frisbee. You know, and that's an interesting story by itself because I played field hockey in Malaysia. I got to campus as a freshman. I thought, hey, maybe I can find where the field hockey games are played. And the Americans would tell me, hang on, only girls play field hockey. Men play ice hockey. And of course, I'm, you know, too small, tropical boy to play ice hockey. But I say, okay, well, then I'm going to find something completely new. And I saw some people playing Ultimate on the field, and it was very different, had never seen it before. And I'm not the type of person who kind of just wants to join in and play and have fun and learn how to throw a Frisbee. I wanted to be one of the best players in the world. So I just really got into it, stayed up at night throwing and throwing, and eventually qualified to, you know, play for the Stanford men's team, right? And all the way up to my final year, where we were the number one ranked team competing at the national championship level. Now, tragically, we lost in that final. So we were the number one undefeated team in the whole country. Rarely had it happened in the last 10 years before. But, you know, it was a very tight finals and we lost that game. And so I was so determined to, you know, take another shot, right? Because you're given 4 years to compete. I didn't play for Stanford my freshman year. So I had more than 1 year of eligibility. So I decided, okay, let me stick around and do my master's so that I could get one more shot at the national championship. So that was why I did my master's program.
And did you get a shot?
That. Oh, you know,
yeah, how did it go?
So that year we lost in the semifinals. So Just because you've got willpower and determination doesn't mean, you know, it's going to lead you to your destiny.
I love how you talked about, I want to be one of the best players in the world. I wonder, is this sort of a value of yours that continues through your career?
You know, I think so, right? So there's that curiosity, but I think it's a very deep curiosity. I didn't want to just kind of scratch on the surface. So for example, you know, when it came to finally leaving Stanford and, you know, getting a real job and getting out into the real world, I had no idea what I wanted to do. But interestingly, in life, the people that you meet, and this is why I'm a big believer in connections. One of my seniors on the Ultimate Frisbee team, Jeff Reed, he had joined a strategy consulting firm. And, you know, I sat down with him and he was telling me about the work that he did, where he would work on different clients from different industries and geographies on various projects every few months, a lot of travel. And I was, you know, fascinated. That's what I want to do, because then I get to try different things in a short span of time. So I immediately, you know, dove in, researched everything I could about, you know, who these different companies are in the consulting field. And I started applying. And I would get rejected one by one by one. We have a tradition at Stanford when you graduate that we would paste our rejection letters outside of our room. I think I had 11 before I got to number 12, one of the global consulting firms in Singapore, who, you know, said, hey, we'd love to have you join us. So for me, it's their obsession to try something new, but I'm going to kind of persevere and persist and keep going, you know, until I kind of get to where I want to go.
So it was through your friend who was doing something that seemed really interesting for you, with the connections part, that's part of it, but also travel seems to feature there as well.
Yes.
That helped you at least get a clue about what you wanted to do next after university.
Right. And then, and of course, then you didn't have a lot in by way of the internet. So you called people up on a phone and say, hey, I really want to learn more about, you know, what you do, right? And 9 out of 10, they won't even bother returning a call. But you find the 10th, and you talk to them and you learn and you ask them for another introduction and you keep going, right? And every rejection, it's not a rejection, but it's like, okay, well, looks like I'm not a fit for your company, but can you give me any feedback, right? What would have made the decision different? And I go back and tweak and, you know, practice and keep going.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about, whether you did something different as you went along through those 11, now 12, applications, the 11 that you were rejected. So clearly you got towards what at least that company was looking for.
Yeah. So I apparently became very good at rejections, because later on, you know, one of the companies I started, iFlix, when we started, we had 115 investors who rejected us because they said, what chance do 5 guys in Kuala Lumpur have to take on a global giant called Netflix? Now, luckily, number 116 from the Philippines said, I think you guys are crazy enough to pull this off, and gave us that funding to start. And of course, as you mentioned, iFlix scaled to 20 million users in 3 years. But that's what it takes, right? It's not 115 similar attempts, but every rejection, what could I have done differently? Tweak, improve, try again, tweak, improve, try again, until you find number 116.
How do you find that resilience, though, to keep going?
Yeah. I wanted to ask about that. I mean, this grit and this resilience that you have, 100 rejections is not a joke. I mean, what kept you...
No hair.
I mean, what kept you going, and what kept you from, like, not doubting yourself? Because even for, you know, when you are in the university, if you have 11 rejections from a consulting company, somebody might think that, you know, maybe this is not the right field for me, or maybe why don't I try something else? But what was it that kind of kept you going, you know, the energy to, you know, even keep on going and pursuing what you had set your mind to?
Well, I think, you know, if you look back, right, the past attempts that made it work, right, from, okay, you know what, I've got to find a way to apply for the right scholarship to get into the right school in the US. That wasn't an easy process, but I got in, right? And I got in. I'm like, okay, well, I want to learn how to play Ultimate Frisbee and I want to be the best Frisbee player. Right? You put in the work, you put in the effort, and you see the results, right? And so that's been a recurring theme, that when you go through a difficult situation, and I deliberately choose difficult things to do, and if you can get through them, not always, but the fact that you can at least go through that whole process, I think gives me the courage, which is that third pillar, to just take the next step, even when you don't know what's ahead of you in the long run, but take one more step ahead.
So what you're saying is that the successes that you had in the past, they kind of built a foundation for you to kind of support you during the hard times that you had. They gave you confidence in your abilities, or
well, I would
strength or courage?
Call them success, but the ability to just keep finding the way forward. For example, right? In my first job, starting in Singapore, it was the mid-1990s. Everything was booming in Southeast Asia. There were a lot of opportunities. And suddenly, 1997 happened, the Asian financial crisis, right? Where your clients, and one of my clients was a bank, was going through, well, they were based on the verge of bankruptcy, and you know, people were losing jobs, and you just had to figure out a way, how do you survive through a period like that, right? And over again, you know, very similar stories. You know, take, for example, building an airline from scratch. We got lucky because we started in 2007, because that just happened to be the year that Alan Greenspan, the Federal Reserve Chairman, said irrational exuberance. There was a ton of capital. We were able to raise $115 million on the back of a business plan. But had we started 6 months later, 2008, the global financial crisis, where all the banks pulled back, everyone pulled out and retreated, right? And you had to figure out how do you survive when all the banks had pulled out. And at the same time, oil prices was, you know, went to an all-time high in 6 months and an all-time low in the following 6 months. Just when you survive that, you know, we started flights to London. There was the 2010 Icelandic volcanic eruption. 2011, we started flights to Japan. There was the Tohoku earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear tragedy. 2012, we started flights to Christchurch, New Zealand. And guess what? The earth shook again, right? Mm. And as difficult as those moments are, the more you get through, the more you realize, okay, when I'm in front of a very difficult situation where I don't know what's ahead, I don't know what's going to happen, but I know I've always been able to take one step forward and keep going and keep learning and keep adjusting and finding the right people to take me through those difficult periods. That is what I think gives me the confidence. I wouldn't call them the past successes, but just the past ability to keep going forward.
Were you born like this? Like, some people are just naturally resilient. Others just, they realize I can survive this stuff so I can keep going. What do you think about that?
Wow. I mean, that's obviously hard, you know, but I think maybe perhaps I'm lucky in the sense that I had parents who gave me the space and freedom to try different things, right? If they say, hey, would you like to learn a musical instrument? Go for it. And 3 months later, I'm completely bored of it. Don't worry about it, right? Find the next thing. And the one thing I really look back and I think, you know, I read a lot of books and, you know, two that definitely stood out for me, Tintin the Adventurer from Belgium and Calvin and Hobbes, right? You know, Curious Imaginations. So these were things that I think shaped, I suppose, the kind of the beliefs I held about going out and seeking adventure and trying and not being afraid of the unknown.
That you could try things, have that confidence. It's okay to give things a go. It's not that perfectionist tendency that some kids have. What about as a parent then? I'm interested. I know you've got kids, some of them are growing up. What are you like then with them?
Well, I definitely try to kind of give them that same space, right? So, for example, encouraging them to make their own decisions about where they want to study, what fields of study. And even my eldest, right? He was torn between music and computer science. And we said, hey, is there a way that you can do a little bit of both? Right. And of course, Melbourne gave him that opportunity. And he came out of that program realizing, I never want to be a software engineer again, right? Having completed that program. And that's completely okay, right? Because I'm a believer that that whole university education is critical, but the most important thing you take away is that you learn how to learn, and you learn how to meet people, and you learn how to stitch new ideas together. So it doesn't matter what exactly you learn in the textbooks, but you learn how to learn and go out and learn new things. And so he's doing, enterprise sales for a telecommunications company here in Malaysia right now.
Yeah. And you studied in the US, and then you said you just wanted to get out of Malaysia for a bit, and you were for quite a few years. What brought you back?
Well, so I started in Singapore, and then 95, 96 was a whole year in Indonesia. 97, during the Asian financial crisis, all the way up to 98, I lived in Bangkok, Thailand, working for Thai Bank. And then I think I spent 1 year in Malaysia in 1999 and 2000. And then 2001 was a whole year in Korea, which is a really great experience. Working with the big chaebols, going through a restructuring period. And specifically, I got to work in the nuclear power industry in Korea.
Wow, a lot of changes over
Yeah.
many years there.
Yeah.
And then you ended up back in Malaysia again for a long time, but you go in and out, right?
Well, so this is, again, it's random things that happen. I like to think about how random phone calls have made big career changes for me. I thought Korea was going to be really hard for a foreigner to be accepted into the small inner circles of business leaders, but after a year, I felt I was accepted. They kind of valued the advice that I provided, and I made a decision. I want to permanently transfer to Korea, right? I even went to the managing partner of McKinsey's Korea office to say, hey, I want to permanently transfer, right? So instead of just being a 1 year secondee, I want to be a member of the Korean firm. And as we were having that conversation, a phone call comes up, and he gets a call from the managing partner in Southeast Asia who says, we just won a mandate to serve the Malaysian Stock Exchange to take them through a privatization and IPO exercise. Azwan's the most senior Malaysian of the firm. Can we have him back? And I said, well, I really want to be in Korea, but sure, I'll help out. I'll go down for 6 weeks to kick things off. 6 weeks turned out to be 6 months, a year. I never went back, and still somewhere in Korea today is my rice cooker and my stereo and my toaster that I never went back to get it. And what started as, helping the chairman of the stock exchange go through his restructuring process, he then said, hey, I've got to now put all your plans and implement them very quickly. No one really understands how a privatized stock exchange to work should work. I can't afford McKinsey fees anymore. I need you to kind of do national service and come join me as an employee to make this happen. Turn your plans into reality. And he was someone I really deeply admired. And when he gave you that challenge, can you just, can you go beyond simply advising to actually making things happen? I took that chance. I took a 50% salary cut, and took on that challenge for the next year and a half, and got the stock exchange privatized. And as we were celebrating that moment, another random phone call from someone who said, hey, I'd love to introduce you to the CEO of Astro, who had also had just gone through an IPO exercise. Just have lunch with him. And that lunch turned out to be, he said, well, we just raised $500 million and we want to expand Astro internationally. Would you like to lead this? I said, well, I don't know anything about television, but $500 million, that's not a bad, stash to play around with. And I took on that opportunity. And we built Astro in Indonesia, in China, in India. And 3.5 years later, another random phone call from another person who said, I'd love for you to have lunch with Tony Fernandez from AirAsia. So there's been a series of random phone calls. So, you know, my big career changes haven't really come from a planned process where I apply for roles. But I think when when you're really into what you do and you really, kind of create new things, people talk about it and they want to meet you.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned random, you mentioned luck before, but I imagine there's something else, around the connections part that you
Yes.
mentioned as well.
Absolutely.
That means that people know about you.
Yes. Yes. And this is before social media. So it's the old way of, meeting people in person, remembering their names, sending written thank you cards, how we used to do it back then.
Yeah. So what do you think are your characteristics that make you memorable, that give you these opportunities?
My dashing good looks. Maybe not.
Despite the no hair.
No, I think, across all of them, it has been to take on difficult, complex challenges and really, drive it all the way to results. For example, right, the challenge with the nuclear industry in Korea was that my client wanted to put together a three-way international joint venture between them as Koreans, a Swiss partner, and an American partner. How do you put together three different cultures into a single business and see how do you make decisions and can you actually, put this complex structure together and make it work? We got that done with the stock exchange in Malaysia, right? I mean, it was a very political process. We had to pass 5 bills in parliament to change the regulatory framework, a lot of stakeholders with conflicting, priorities and preferences. You just put it together, work through all the difficult challenges and people hear about it, right? And that's how the CEO of Astro and said, I want to meet that person, right? Who was the guy who made that happen, right? And Astro, for example, when I started Astro in Indonesia, from trying to interview the first employee at my hotel room, 10 months later, we had 450 employees, a fully functional broadcast center in the middle of Jakarta, 5 local Indonesian channels, and nationwide distribution in 10 months. Not a lot of sleep. And, when people kind of hear that ability to just move fast, execute, deliver results, that led to that phone call from AirAsia.
So Aswin, I have a question about the different roles that you've held.
Right.
It seems like every time you move, it's not just, you're moving to a new role. It's a completely different role and in a completely different industry. So for somebody who's looking at your profile or just kind of sifting through your profile, and they're trying to see, what is the connection? What is the common thread? So what do you think is the thread that's running through all the different positions that you've held, and how do you make some of these career decisions? I know that you talked about like solving complex problems, but I mean, is there something else that you're looking at?
Sure. There are a couple of themes. The first is that binds across all of these seemingly disparate industries is that point of inception where you've got an idea, right? Whether it is that business plan to put 3 parties with, in nuclear power in Korea or the stock exchange or Astro and AirAsia, it's at the initial stage, right? You're trying to create and bring to life a business plan, a piece of paper. So I'll probably be not as effective fish out of water if you put me into a big, multi-billion dollar company with 20,000 employees. I tend to be better when I'm at that early stage, number one. Number two, all of them, the other common thread is it's all about how do we re-examine traditional industry products and services and find different ways to make it much more affordable and accessible to the mass market segments in emerging markets. So I wouldn't be great with premium luxury brands, for example, right? But how do you understand, okay, if Cathay Pacific and Singapore Airlines operate this way, what's different about the needs of a low-cost budget traveler who do want to travel far away to Sydney or Tokyo? How do you do it differently? If someone can afford, a satellite television subscription, how can you make a $2 a month model work for an emerging markets consumer in Bangladesh or Philippines, right? So that's the other kind of common thread, so it's not just the complexity, but it's that specific complexity, the inception stage and the focus on mass market consumers.
I've got a question. Tell us a bit more about what you're doing now with Naluri.
So I think when you take those threads, and interestingly, another random coffee conversation where we talked about finding your purpose in life. And this person I met said, you know what? If you could find the intersection between three circles, circle number one, what are you good at? What are you good at, Azran? I said, well, you know what? People have been paying me and bringing me in to build these business plans from scratch, convince investors to raise capital, put teams together, paint a powerful, inspiring vision, and grow aggressively. Okay, so that's what you've been doing. But if you didn't have to worry about money at all, what would you do? What's your real passion? And my first instinct was triathlons. What do you like about it? Because clearly, I'm not going to be a professional triathlete at 50, but I love that challenge, that whole physical challenge, but also the mental endurance to keep going when your body is crying to stop. It's the power of the mind over your body to just keep going, right? Okay. Now, third question. What's a big problem in the world that you care deeply about? I said, well, coming from that AirAsia and iFlix experience, I think the big problem in the world that I see that I'm really, passionate about is how our societies globally are polarizing between the haves and have-nots, the 1% versus the 99%. And that's why I love to find ways to make services more affordable and accessible, because it's my way of helping to close that gap. And so you say, well, if you put those three things together, have you thought about building a new tech business in health and resilience for the mass market? And sometimes, these conversations don't just stop at a coffee shop. But I was immediately intrigued, right? The neurons were firing, and I immediately somehow latched onto something that I had just gone through then, where I had lost my own father to diabetes and cancer. And a couple of things struck me, right? Number one, I realized, the healthcare system today is only focused on people's physical health, right? They were telling him about this medication, that surgery, chemotherapy, radiotherapy. No one had thought about or provided any support for what we now learn was the depression and anxiety that he went through. And when you don't provide that support that led to missed medication, skipped chemo sessions, things just kind of got worse. So the healthcare system today is very siloed. And we don't really link physical and mental health together. And the second part is you realize, hospitals and doctors are reactive. They sit there and wait for patients to get sick and distressed and come to them. But by then, it's costly, it's complex. But what if there's a way to find people who may seem like they're still healthy, but they are already at risk? They have early risk factors, and help them earlier to reduce the likelihood that they may actually need expensive medical treatment and procedures down the line. And so I guess once I got really, excited about that problem, I wanted to just dive in. And so I told my co-founders at iFlix, I love you guys, still a shareholder, call me if you need any support, but I'm going to build something from scratch. And I started with one LinkedIn post to say, I've got a crazy idea. I want to build something in health. I'm looking for one intern to help me. I got 220 replies, and I found one intern who stood out, and that's how we started from my living room until we made a mess and we got kicked out and we had to move to the coffee shop downstairs.
And so that's what you're doing. You sound like a bit of a startup junkie.
Yes, I
Are you a
guess.
bit addicted to it?
Yeah, like the blank sheet of paper, right? That there are no constraints, no existing ways. You just have to put everything together from scratch. Whether it's the people side, the technology, the first line of code, the first customer, right? The first dollar that you earn. That's what excites me.
Astrid, I have a question regarding navigating crisis situations. I mean, you were talking about, you gave a lot of examples, during your Air Asia days, for example, where you had the global financial crisis. And I guess towards the end of it, you had the MH370 around 2014 or something like that, which put especially the Malaysian air industry in a little bit of a flux. And now we've had the pandemic. So you've been, it seems like ever since you've started this startup journey, you've been facing events which are kind of like once in a lifetime event that would happen to anybody, and you've faced like so many of them. So I guess my question is, and you talk about luck, but I'm sure that there is something beyond that, maybe it's in your approach. How do you navigate some of these crisis situations? I mean, for the rest of us, maybe we are not like heading organizations, or we may not be in situations that you've been through. But if you had to have, if you were to give maybe some kind of an advice on some of your approach to going through some of these crisis situations, what do you think that would be?
Okay, sure. When we go through crisis situations, two things hold us back. Number one, we tend to do things the same way. What's familiar to us, what's comfortable to us. We like routine and predictability, and we tend to gravitate more to it the more the external environment is uncertain. And the second thing that holds us back is we expect other people to change first. My boss is wrong, and my client is wrong, and they should change because I'm right. But when you expect others to change, you actually wallow in your own misery and frustration because they're not going to change. But we somehow expect other people to change first, rather than saying, what can I do about that situation? Now, that sounds kind of, for me, it wasn't an easy lesson to learn. So I do want to come back and share with you the story of what I call my biggest professional failure. How I was fired by my board of directors of the airline industry, right? You mentioned basically, in 2013, I thought I was king of the world. We went from that business plan to a $1 billion IPO in 2013 in 6 years. We expanded aggressively, placed, a big order for aircraft. But what we didn't count on was the very next year in 2014, three black swan events. The first that you mentioned, MH370, that plane that went missing in March. Just when you're trying to recover from that, July was MH17 that was shot down over Ukraine. And then in December, QZ8501, the fatal plane crash between Indonesia and Singapore. And although the three are not directly under me, the impact to our business was brutal because travel demand into Malaysia plummeted. And we put all these capacity. Now, first, I thought as a leader, we're meant to be decisive during times of crisis. So I came up with what I thought was the right logical approach for how we should navigate the airline out of that crisis, where I told my board, I'm going to take 50% of my capacity away from these markets that we're in, because demand have plummeted, and if we just kept the planes there, it would be just bleeding cash. I'm going to lease them out to other airlines in other parts of the world who need extra capacity, like European airlines who need extra flights for summer charters to the Caribbean, North African airlines who need extra Umrah and Hajj pilgrimage flights, so that at least those aircraft capacity will earn some money instead of just being, underutilized in our markets and bleeding cash. Plus, in 2014, the other thing that happened was that our Asian currencies that we earn revenue in, the Malaysian ringgit, Indonesian rupiah, Australian dollars, Taiwan dollars, Japanese yen, all crashed against the US dollar. And 70% of an airline's cost is US dollars. So at least with this leasing model, I denominate that leasing contract in US dollars to reduce the currency mismatch between the revenues that we earn and our costs. Good, sound, logical strategy. Except my board disagreed and they just wanted to stay the course, right? And I dug my heels in and I said, no, that is wrong. Right? The right thing to do is this. They didn't like that and they asked me to leave. So number one, you know, when I look back, it took me over a year to kind of let this reflect, stew down, let my anger come back down to realize, you know what, in times of crisis, we all tend to gravitate to what we're familiar. They were also in a shock, right? And going to them and saying, we're going to change, there's even more resistance. I'll give you an example, right, Richira and Felicity. You might have had a friend or family member during COVID who was hesitant to take a vaccine. Yeah? Now, if you went to them and say, hey, look at all the WHO research on vaccine efficacy and you know, its benefits, are you going to convince them with data? Probably not, right?
No.
Because they have a view, and when you push an alternate view in front of them, the more they dig their heels in. And that's what we all tend to do in these moments of crisis. My biggest failure was I did not connect before I correct. I didn't establish that bond of trust with each individual board member to make them feel like I'm looking out for their concerns. I hear them out. I ask, should we do this or that? Make them feel like they're part of the decision rather than going and saying, this is the right thing to do, right? And so I think those are my biggest takeaways when I think about how do we navigate from crisis and uncertainty is not to be aware that we have these biases. We think we were supposed to be decisive, but we all have quickly developed tunnel vision. I developed tunnel vision thinking this is the one right strategy, which by the way, I still think is the right thing to do. We should have and my board members said, no, we're just going to stick to what we're familiar with, just like our friends. No, I don't want to take that vaccine. So it's not about whether you've got the right logical answer, but establishing that connection first. And that is why that second Azran principle of connection matters. And it becomes even more important than curiosity and courage in times of crisis.
I have a question about whether you think leaders are born or are they made?
Oof. I'm a big believer in the kind of the made part, because it is the experiences that we go through that shape our judgment, our values, the people that we surround ourselves with. And by the way, that's the other part of the Azran story. The AirAsiaX, iFlix, Nullary story isn't just about Azran. It is also about Moses Devanayagam, right? He helped me build AirAsiaX. He came from the airline industry with 36 years of experience. But what made him unique was, unlike most people who've been in one industry for 30 years and are set in his ways, he was open. He entertained my crazy ideas, but he will help me point to say, oh, if you want to do that, we're going to have to tackle this. And it was that insight that an outsider like me would not have been able to figure out, right? I built iFlix with Mark Britt. He had built internet television in Australia. We brought him into Southeast Asia. And when I wanted to start Nullary, I partnered with Dr. Jeremy Ting, a medical doctor and healthcare system specialist. So, you know, I think a big part, it's who you surround yourself with, right? Mm-hmm. People with very different skill sets, experiences, and you need to kind of establish that healthy trust and openness so that you can, you know, debate in a, you know, in a non-threatening, non-judgmental way, right? And so I think who we choose around us is super critical.
Yeah, great. So tell us, what is next for you, Azran?
Oh dear, right. So, you know, I'm a big believer in not predicting what's going to happen 3 years out, 5 years out. I have no idea because, you know, remember back in January 2022 when we thought we were done with COVID, none of us predicted that Russia would invade Ukraine, that inflation would be at 40-year highs, and, you know, that, you know, here in Malaysia, we run out of cooking oil and chicken, So the world clearly is changing at a lot faster rate, right? So it's not necessarily about a specific destination that I want to be. But I think, you know, going forward, it is more about how do I find different ways to bring curiosity, connection, and courage to life. I do want to start, I keep meeting more different people from different backgrounds. I think the world has no shortage of complex, tough problems that need, you know, crazy, unproven solutions. And I'd love to play a role in tackling those problems.
Well, beautiful. It's a really great way to think, I think, to finish, Ruchira, you're right, with that, to say thank you so much, Azran, today for sharing us, giving us some great insights about your amazing career journey. And we could talk for hours. Like, there's so much to learn from you. The Azran story, the crazy ideas, the curiosity, connection, courage, and that wanting to solve the world's tough issues there, the problems that we have. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Azran. It was really enlightening. Thanks so much.